Chapter 4 Anchor Point was one of many refueling and layover stops serving several interstellar shipping lanes. The size of a small moon, it was a hodgepodge of variously sized chunks that might have been stuck together at the shifting whims of a very inventive child, using pieces from several different sets of toys. Construction was always in progress here, either to add new areas or to expand and modify existing ones to accommodate the needs of a changing population. Not that turnover was especially rapid. Anchor Point was home to a military installation and a small but substantial number of artificial persons assigned to the station's permanent staff. However, the vast majority of people in residence were employees on long-term contract with one of the many businesses leasing workspace. Exactly how long any term of employment might be varied from company to company, but as nobody went into cold sleep for a long weekend in the middle of interstellar nowhere, the scale was measured in years. Depending on the type of job, some people stayed for only 3 years, although 5 was the usual minimum. Over half the contractors would re-up for another 5 or even 7, most often to finish a project and to collect the increased remote location bonus. Very few people stayed any longer. Those who worked in the scientific and technological fields seldom renewed their contracts more than once. Places like Anchor Point were resume fodder. You paid your dues by taking whatever contract was available in the middle of nowhere so that later you could get the position you really wanted in the middle of somewhere better. This had been the grand plan that Tully, Charles A., had been working from when he'd signed a 5-year contract as a tech in the Weyland-Yutani Tissue Laboratory. Now, 6 months into his second 5, he'd realized to his great dismay that he wasn't looking as far ahead as he had when he'd first taken up residence in one of the many sleeping cubicles that housed the unmarried, the uncommitted, and the unfocused. Everyone in Tully's neighborhood was under 30, and most, including Tully, were under 25, which meant they were still young enough to tolerate dorm-style accommodations, i.e., one room, and not a very big room at that. More like a cell. But they all had doors that locked, unlike the Marines, who had to live in barracks without any privacy. The decor in Tully's cubicle was what a behavioral psychologist might have called new adult immature fledgling, a chaotic nest of clothing interspersed with shiny bits of high-tech gadgets slash toys and tools. Shelving, barely wide enough for a small water glass, took up some of the wall space. Tully had covered the rest with photos of landscapes from worlds he'd probably never visit. There was a window. The Whole Person Well-Being Act required that all space stations provide at least one in each discrete residence. Anchor points were actually 10.19 square centimeters larger than the legal minimum. Regardless of how big the windows were, however, the scenery left a lot to be desired. If you were new to life in space, the view was breathtaking. For all of 3 days. Then you realized you'd seen everything there was to see. The stars didn't actually do anything. They didn't move, didn't change, and out in space, they didn't even twinkle. Nor would spaceships sail past your slightly larger than the minimum window in stately silence. Spacecraft came and went from an area on the other side of the station so that any unfortunate incidents, like explosions, wouldn't endanger the residents. Much. If you wanted to watch vessels come and go, there was a viewing terrace, but arrivals and departures weren't that frequent, and if you'd seen one, you'd seen them all. So much for exciting adventures in outer space. For Tully, however, the space inside Anchor Point was the more difficult adjustment. Even in the generously large common areas, he was always conscious of an absolute limit to the dimensions. When you went for a walk on a planet, you might come to a fence with a no trespassing sign and either turn away or defy it at your own risk, depending on your mood. But on a space station, you always came to a bulkhead, and that was it. End of the line. You couldn't go on because there was nothing to go on to. That feeling of being contained inside a place with no outside was always with him. A low but unceasing agitation rippling at the edge of his awareness. Anchor Point seemed, well, not crowded exactly, just a bit too small. This was in spite of the fact that when he had lived on Earth, he'd never cared for long walks or climbing over fences and trespassing. Even as a kid, he'd opted to stay in and read. Apparently, having the choice to be inside or outside affected him on a level he wasn't even aware of. After almost 6 years, he was comfortable enough to function, but Anchor Point would never feel completely normal to him, except for his sleep cubicle. It was the one place where he actually felt at home. And like most techs, he was hardly ever there, except to sleep. The comm had been ringing for a while before Tully finally became aware of it. He slept like the dead, always had. Spence had helped him rig the lights to go on whenever he got a call, otherwise the device would probably burn out before he heard it. Unless his neighbors, driven mad by the noise, broke in to slaughter him first. If they ever did, it would be Mandala Jackson's fault. As chief of operations, Jackson could override anyone's voicemail whenever she felt it was necessary. Supposedly, this was in compliance with the Whole Person Well-Being Act, so that anyone incapacitated by illness or injury while alone wouldn't spend hours suffering, possibly even dying, just because everyone else was respecting their privacy. In reality, it meant no one could dodge work calls even when they were off duty. Tully groaned as he sat up, reluctantly knuckling sleep out of his eyes with one hand and slapping the comm on the table beside the bed with the other. Jackson appeared on the screen, as usual, wearing one of her stupid baseball caps with her stupid light pen clipped to the bill, her stupid jerry-rigged version of hands-free. Behind her, however, the activity in operations looked practically frantic, and that wasn't usual. "Morning, Tully," she said. "Morning," he winced. "Jesus, Jackson, I'm still on scheduled downtime. My morning's not for another day and a half."
"Cry me a river," she said. "Later. In ops, we don't get luxuries like downtime. 16 hours ago, a marine transport came in on automatic." Her head bobbed as she aimed the light pen at the left side of the screen. "Ship's called the Sulaco. 4 years ago, it left Gateway with 15 souls aboard. 12 colonial marines, an android, a rep from Weyland Yutani, and some ex-warrant officer from a merchant vessel that blew up."
"So?" Tully asked sourly.
"So, let me finish," Jackson said. "The bioscan readout says it now has 3 people aboard. The ex-warrant officer," she nodded, and the light pen made a thick line at the bottom of the screen as she ticked them off. "1, count 'em, 1 marine, a 9-year-old girl who happens to be the only surviving colonist from LV-426, and half an artificial person. The bottom half. Makes you wonder what the hell happened out there, doesn't it?"
"Ask them," Tully said.
"Not me."
Jackson's sudden bright smile was bizarre as well as dismaying.
"But that's the good news," she said, as if it really were. 3 hours before the Sulaco turned up, we docked a chartered priority transport out of Gateway. The Mona Lisa had 2 passengers, both Millisai. Her smile became even brighter. "Weapons division."
Tully's heart sank. Hard. Anything involving Millisai's weapons division usually came with a body count.
"Isn't that the bad news?" he asked,
too dispirited to be wittier. Jackson ignored him.
"Our new Millisai friends want us to grab the Sulaco in full biohazard mode by 0800 hours. Senior biotechs have priority for deck crew assignments, and the most senior of them all is the one and only you, Tully Charles A."
He opened his mouth to protest, but the screen went blank.
"Oh, shit," he said, meaning it with all his heart.
With a tremendous effort, he hauled himself to a sitting position and started sorting through the clothes immediately within reach for something wearable, smell being his primary criterion. Wrinkles didn't matter. People expected lab techs to be rumpled. But even the biggest slobs were squeamish about bodily aromas. The clothing he tossed to one side on the bed stirred, then fell off as Spence sat up beside him, smearing her dark, unruly curls back from her sleepy brown face.
"What is it?"
she asked through a yawn, watching him sniff at a shirt.
"It is something called the military-industrial complex," he replied. "It is also called getting my ass out of bed too soon and me being jerked around. Whatever you call it, by any other name," he sniffed another shirt, decided it could do one more shift. "It is the same old bullshit."
Spence nodded resignedly and got up to help him. 5 minutes later, Tully stepped into the hallway, still a little groggy but fully clothed, wearing, despite Spence's advice to the contrary,
a battered flight jacket over his acceptable shirt and slightly stained trousers. The jacket sleeves were festooned from shoulder to wrist with an assortment of embroidered patches bearing the logos of various products and companies. Anchor Point strongly encouraged all residents to promote companies leasing space from them so they'd feel appreciated and thus inclined to do more business. His gaze fell on the ID posted beside the door, displaying his name, photo, job description, and contact info. The photo had been taken the day he'd arrived, all bright-eyed and excited about getting a new job on a space station, yet apprehensive about measuring up, a feeling his grandmother had called enthusianxious. Yeah, that described the guy in the photo perfectly. Enthusianxious. Eager to please, clueless as a puppy. "So is it everything you hoped for?" he asked the photo silently. That bright-eyed, fresh-faced rookie would probably have said yes. "Sucker," he muttered, but a bit wistfully